Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. How do we define the good society? Is it through phrases such as the true test of a good society is the way it treats the meanest of its members? If so, how do we stack up? Have the years of government cutbacks and efficiency dividends weakened our provision of public services to the extent that they are now beginning to find it difficult to deliver on their core functions? That's one of the observations coming out of this week's census debacle. Has this spilled over into meanness and even harshness in the provision of services? From the horrors of Dondale revealed a couple of weeks ago to our willingness to tolerate abuse in our offshore detention facilities on Nauru. Is the real difficulty facing our budget not that we do not have enough wealth as a nation to fund the good society, but that we cannot agree on who should bear the cost? Is the country of the fair go becoming the country of I'm all right, Jack? Well, joining us to discuss paying for the good society is Ross Gittins, economics editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, Misha Coleman of the Church's Refugee Task Force, and Major Brendan Nottle of the Salvation Army 614 Project in Melbourne. Thank you all for joining us.
John,
good to be here, John.
Brendan Nottle, I understand on Tuesday, census night, you were out collecting census data on those sleeping rough in the city of Melbourne.
That's right, John. We're out with teams that have been trained by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and we went everywhere, not just under bridges and down laneways and places like that, but we're also in boarding houses and refuges and hostels and trying to get to people that were couch surfing as well, because we weren't just trying to count people that were rough sleeping, but the definition of homelessness, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, is much broader than that. It's actually people that don't have secure tenure in terms of their accommodation. So we really wanted to connect with them. And it's critical to do so, John, because the anecdotal evidence is that rough sleeping particularly is significantly on the rise right across Australia. And yet we've gone through an entire federal election campaign where homelessness was not mentioned once. And I find that to be an absolute disgrace when everywhere I go, I'm constantly being asked questions by very concerned ordinary people about what's happening in terms of rough sleeping on our streets and what are we doing about trying to address this issue of homelessness. And yet our federal politicians, none of them raised the issue once, and none of them talked about the contributing issues to homelessness either. So the ABS data is absolutely critical where we start to hopefully come up with a very definitive measure of the number of people that are homeless right across the nation, and hopefully that starts to form some type of policy that will begin to address the issue of homelessness right across the nation.
Yes, and perhaps later on we could talk about some of the subsets of that, or the stuff that goes along with that. That is the level of benefits such as the New Start allowance and things like that. Misha Coleman, the revelations surrounding Nauru this week and the way they were received seem to indicate a political willingness, or perhaps even a social willingness, to tolerate a level of inhumanity that speaks of almost a numbness in our social conscience. What do you make of it?
Yes, I think numbness is a good way to describe it, John. I was actually talking to an ABC producer today who, and I said, why didn't you cover it? And he said there was no vision. And I suppose if you compare the response that we had to the Dondale torture and ill treatment of children, and even the response to, you know, exposés of, you know, cruelty against animals in the live export trade or the greyhound trade, you know, the trigger seems to be this graphic footage on, you know, sort of primetime TV. But I remember back earlier this year, there was a young man who set himself alight on Nauru, and that was captured on an iPhone, and during the UNHCR visit to the camps, and while that footage, for obvious reasons, well, maybe not obvious reasons, that footage wasn't shown on primetime TV. It was certainly on all the news channels on their websites. It was absolutely, you know, the guy set himself alight and died. It's, you know, it doesn't get much worse than that.
It's interesting that back in 1968 or 70, when Buddhist monks were doing that in Saigon in protest over the Vietnam War, though that footage was shown live on our TV screens at a time when we were much more sensitive about those sorts of things.
Well, that's right. And I remember a number, like I was sitting on, you know, Twitter, as I do, that night during the Four Corners episode when they aired the footage of the abuse of the kids in Don Dale. And the Twitter, all of a sudden, it just erupted with, you know, oh, this must be, you know, in one of the camps, it must be in the offshore centre, which asylum seeker is it, all this sort of thing. And, you know, it was almost like, okay, we're used to seeing that type of thing within our detention centre framework. We're used to hearing about it. We're even used to seeing it. And so in some ways it's almost a case for despair when that type of evidence can be so, you know, so oft seen. And I know myself, we received letters, I've got them sitting in here in front of me, 13 handwritten letters which were smuggled out of the Nauru Centre in 2014, which actually go through, I mean, one of them was a woman's will, because she was about to take her own life. And I gave those letters directly to the department, to the Prime Minister's office, to Scott Morrison, completely under the radar. It wasn't a, you know, media stunt or anything like that. Assuming, and, you know, this is back in 2014, assuming that the sorts of, you know, there was an allegation of rape, which was later borne out to be true, and then cover-up by the department, assuming that those things would be sort of jumped on and acted on and investigated straight away, and actually none of them were, and the worst allegations of that set of letters that we were given were referred to the Moss Review, but ultimately the investigations were referred back to the Nauruan police, who we know are actually part of the problem.
What inferences do you draw from that? I mean, not just as a policy person, but as a human being.
Yeah, well, it sickens me to my core, and there's not an inference. It's obviously a very, very deliberate system which is designed A, not to work, and B, it's beyond deterrence. It's something that is I think is the worst. It's the worst type of public policy probably this country has ever seen. And like I said, it is completely designed not to work, not to process people, not to resettle people. And the idea, I mean, the response from the government this week, the response was that we already knew. So in the same way as the Don Dale revelations, you know, the response from... It was incredible that they already knew, or we already had these reports, was some sort of response, was sort of unbelievable. And I guess that was a really shocking part of the Nauru letters and the 2000 incidents. The private sector security contractor, Wilson Security on Nauru, has this database. It's got this sort of incident database, and that's where all of those reports came from. And, you know, you'd be surprised to learn, John, that, you know, if there are complaints against Wilson Security staff, they might not even end up in that database. We know that to be true from people who've worked there. So, you know, I think those 2000 incidences are, you know, the ones that made it through. But for the government to respond by saying this is not news, it defies description, except to say the government are out of ideas and out of alternatives. And, you know, Lee Sales, bless her heart, on 7:30 when she was interviewing Mr. Dutton, was, you know, saying, like, you've been saying this for 3 years now. You know, his the tired old responses of finding a third country to resettle. Why would any other country who all have their own people seeking asylum and people, you know, claiming refugee status, why would they take, you know, our political problem off our hands when we're so equipped to deal with it? And then I saw today David Shearer from New Zealand said, we will take these people. You know, New Zealand has said, we will take these people. And Australia, the Australian government has said, no, you will not. We will not allow you to.
I'd like to touch on some of those issues a little later in some more detail. But just give me a brief observation of what you think is going on here. Is the Australian public coarsened in its attitudes over the years, or is it a failure at the political level? Just briefly.
It's a complete failure of political leadership. When Malcolm Fraser introduced the plan to resettle people from Indochina in the 70s, it wasn't a wholly popular plan. It wasn't a plan, an idea that had, you know, 100% community support, but it was a response that displayed leadership and courage, and ultimately, you know, several years down the track, we know that it was a success. It was a good thing to do. It was the right thing to do. But it was actually a very successful plan. And, you know, that involved
flying people here. Well, it involved bipartisan support as well.
Ultimately, it did. Yeah. But not, you know, for those, obviously, it was before my time, John. But, you know, people weren't wholly approving of that, you know, the idea and the plan at the time, but there was political leadership to say, well, you know, there is not another country that's going to take 100,000 people from Indochina. We're on the, you know, we would rather fly people in, have people, you know, sort of processed in a you know, it's a proper way, if you like to call it that, than have people arrive on boats, and that's what they did.
It took a strong act of political courage on Malcolm Fraser's part, but also on the part of the Labor Party, who had Mick Young, I think, flying around as
indeed.
Well.
Indeed.
Ross Gittins, let me come to you. The retiring governor of the Reserve Bank, Glenn Stevens, made a speech this week that seemed to urge decision makers to come up with some remedies soon. That is, that there is a crisis in the budget, but the crisis isn't that we are too poor a country to pay for all we want. The crisis is a lack of willingness to make a decision.
I think that's true. It's certainly true that we're a rich country. To hear our politicians talk, you would think that we're a very poor country and somehow we've been lumbered with all this stuff. Well, actually, we can afford it all. The thing is that we don't want to pay for it, and there are arguments between different groups in the community about whether they should pay more. Basically, the government hasn't been willing to ask anybody to pay anything more in higher taxes. What we saw from the coalition's first budget in 2014 was the electorate saying, no, you don't. You promised not to cut this stuff. Don't cut it. And in any case, you made that promise because you knew we didn't want it cut and we still don't want it cut. Well, that's fine. If we want it, we don't have a huge public sector. We don't have the government spending huge amounts relative to the wealth of the country. But what we've got is a reluctance to pay for it. I think we do need cuts. I'm not desperately worried about our deficits and debt. That problem is greatly exaggerated. It is true that we need to ensure that the money the government spends is well spent. But the way we've been going about that is to say, oh, well, we couldn't possibly afford to give a discretionary increase in the dole. That would be just not possible. We can't afford to help poor people in other countries. We're running a deficit. Now, we're running a deficit because we're spending a big on defence and lots of other things, but that doesn't matter. We can run a deficit to spend up big on defence, but we can't run a deficit to help poor people in other countries. In fact, we're not all that keen to help poor people in Australia.
What is the current level of unemployment benefit compared to the old poverty line? I think the famous Henderson poverty line, which was struck way back in the Whitlam era, how do we compare with that?
We could have an entire program arguing about that one. a figure was said, came up the other day that said the unemployment benefits are about a third lower than the poverty line. Now, that is indefensible. We are a prosperous country. Most of us are doing reasonably well. Even those of us who have a bit of trouble balancing the budget every week are still not living a third below the poverty line. And that's crazy when you have politicians saying, well, and economists and business people saying, well, you know, some industries have got to expand and others have got to contract. People worry about losing their jobs, understandably, and they worry even more when the help that the community gives them, if they were to lose their job, is an amount that you couldn't possibly live on.
Yes, it's been jokingly called the no-start allowance. That is, it's not enough to pay the fares to get you to the job interviews you're required to do.
Well, that's actually I'll remember that. I'll use that.
One other thing, the level of taxation is constantly argued about. Oh, we're very high taxed in this country. We've got to cut taxes. We've got to cut personal taxes. We've got to cut company taxes. We've got to cut 20. How does one make sense of this debate generally, globally in Australia? How are we taxed as a nation? High or low or middle?
We're not taxed highly at all by the standards of prosperous countries. Now, if you compare us to the poorest countries that you can find in Asia, we pay more tax than them. But that's a silly comparison because they don't have our welfare state. They don't have unemployment benefits. They don't have Medicare. They don't have the age pension. If we want to have all of those things, and of course it's inconceivable that we'd want to live in a country that didn't have that net to pick us up whenever we had a problem, then we have to pay the taxes that go with it. But in fact, because our welfare system is means-tested, heavily means-tested, that's actually the reason why Australian taxes are low relative to what people pay in Europe.
So we have a fairly tightly administered system.
We do, very tight, and the government keeps tightening it.
Yes.
Every time they need a buck, they say, we're going to have a crackdown on welfare cheats. Well, they have a crackdown on welfare cheats about every 6 months.
Yes.
I don't think there are that many of them left.
But the other corollary of that too, and I think this was alluded to on census night, was the part of the problem was the consistent, well, we'll have a crackdown on the bloated public sector.
Yes. The thing is, the government isn't prepared and can't get through the Senate measures to cut back what the money that ordinary people get, say to make people pay $7 to go and see a GP. But the one part where they can cut without any kickback from the public and where they appeal to the prejudices of a lot of people who think that public servants are people who do no work, they just sit around drinking tea, is you cut back the public sector. And they do it all the time. They do it because it's easy.
And both sides have done it.
Both sides do it, definitely. It's easy. It has no political comeback. The problem with it is what we saw on census night. You keep cutting these guys. Guess what? They can't do the job properly.
Because the prime problem on census night had to do with the capacity of the gear and the programs they were using.
Yes, and it had to do with years of neglect, years of neglect of the computer system. The Bureau of Statistics went for a year without a leader. If you've got a government department where it doesn't have a head, nobody makes any hard decisions. Because there's no one there to say, I'm the boss, I make the decision. If it falls apart, blame me.
And we complete the circle back to Brendan. That is, if you don't have the capacity to collect the data, which Brendan was out busily trying to collect, you can't make the decisions necessary to build the sort of society we say we want to build.
Well, we and certainly, not busily. I mean, it's a demonstration that, you know, the Brendans of the world are a demonstration that we need good statistical information about the extent of things such as homelessness. And if and you can't, the idea that we can run a modern economy and do our counting on the cheap is absolutely crazy.
Ross,
if ever there was a time when we ought to be putting more money into making sure we've got good measurements of all the dimensions that we're concerned about, now is it.
I've got to ask you one question. I want to bring Brenda and Misha into the observation again, and it's the question I asked both of them. Do you think the essence of the problem is with the culture generally, that is, we've become a meaner society, or is it locked somehow in the prism of Canberra and the way politics is being played out?
I am never comfortable when we all sit around saying, we've got these terrible... we're all great guys, but we got these. We're afflicted with these terrible politicians who are all hopeless and make all these crazy decisions. We get the politicians we deserve, and if they're bad, they reflect a problem with us.
Brendan.
Well, just on the point of collecting data, John, thank goodness we didn't have to use a computer when we were out collecting the homeless data. We had hard copy, which everybody should have had. Anyway, so we got our information collected and we continue to collect it as well. But look, I find it really interesting. I mentioned before, wherever I go, all people want to talk about is their deep concern for people sleeping rough of our streets and on our streets. And this
so you
year,
don't think the public's generally got meaner?
I'm not seeing that. I'm actually seeing the opposite. I think they've become even more compassionate than what they've been. And I think there's a complete disconnect between what's happening. Because the people I talk to on the streets, John, are actually describing our homeless situation as a crisis. I hear it all the time. And yet no one during the federal election mentioned it. And I think there's a complete disconnect between what's happening with some of these really significant, wicked problems and the attitude of towards those problems amongst ordinary people and what's happening in Canberra.
Do you see any evidence of what used to be called the doll bludger syndrome? That is, people blaming the poor for their own condition?
No, we're certainly not seeing that now, particularly in that area of homelessness. I think people are embarrassed. I think people are ashamed that in this city, particularly Melbourne, the world's most livable city, well, we have been for a couple of years now, that there are people sleeping on our streets and cannot find accommodation, and they cannot find accommodation with the supports that they need. We've got 32,000 people on the public housing waiting list here in Victoria, John. And last year, according to our information, only 80 new houses were built to address that issue of 32,000 people on the waiting list. We've got a massive problem here, and it's a matter of priorities. You know, we've seen the Olympic Games and all the hoo-ha around that. I heard during the week that it costs Australian taxpayers $9 million for each gold medal that we've won in this Olympic Games. Now, Ross would know if that's correct or not, but I've picked that up from a number of people. So the priority is that sort of glory, and I know there's spin-offs and benefits for young people and children being inspired to lead active lives. I understand that. But at the same time, we have people living on the streets. We have people living in terrible rooming houses. And nothing's being mentioned about it at a federal level. In fact, we don't even have a federal housing minister or a homelessness minister. So that goes to talk about some of the priorities of government, and not just government, it's political parties as well. And I think the other difficulty we've got in terms of Canberra is thinking often seems to revolve around electoral cycles. So governments seem to be making decisions based on what they need to do to get elected at the next election. And yet some of these wicked problems need very long-term strategic thinking and strategic plans to be developed and budgets developed that are adhered to in a bipartisan way, regardless of the state of the economy, for the long term, beyond the electoral cycle. And I think that's the only way we're going to address problems such as homelessness and those contributing issues like trauma, mental health, addiction issues, and a lack of affordable housing across the nation.
Misha Coleman, there is one other button that we haven't referred to yet that seems to be pressed particularly around the area of migrants and refugees. That's the fear button. And it's the oldest button in the Australian political playbook. It dates back to the years even before there was an Australia. It dates back to the days when each of the colonies, whether it be whatever migrant group was coming in, whether it was the Chinese or the Irish or whomever, they were a group to be feared because they were going to ruin our way of life. Is that? Do you see evidence of that fear button being pressed? And people particularly refer to that being pressed during the most recent federal election campaign.
Well, it was pressed in week two of the eight-week election campaign. So as soon as the coalition's numbers started to look very unhealthy, Scott Morrison was trucked out to, you know, do the whole Tampa thing all over again. And, you know, there is a generational thing, you know, and I think that, a retired gentleman was saying to me today, you know, Howard's children have grown up. We were talking about, you know, what's going on? Why do people, you know, not vote according to, you know, social issues? And why aren't there any votes in homelessness or these intractable sort of social problems that are making this country, a meaner place to live? And he was talking about, you know, Howard's children and these sort of people who've come of age and are now sort of very used to these ideas of mutual obligation and the race card. And, you know, it was okay to bag the Chinese and then people seeking asylum and now, you know, people from the Middle East or, it's the whole sort of anti-Islam thing. So that all sort of became okay under Howard. And, of course, you know, Howard blames the Hanson factor for him having to sort of veer to the right. But it was also an excuse to veer to the right. And I suppose just going back to your thesis around why people don't act or why people don't get as outraged over the sorts of abuses that we know, you know, kids and women and mums and dads are experiencing in these detention centres. I think there's a real sense of frustration with the old parties that are not proposing any alternatives when we know there are a range of alternatives available. And I remember, the great MP, Anna Burke, recently retired, said to me that after Reza Barati was murdered in Manus Island, the young Iranian guy, she said she got three emails. Whereas, you know, on any given day, you know, you would get hundreds of emails about a range of different issues. And in the sort of entirety of those weeks that followed, she had three people contact to her to express their outrage. But I don't think it's because people aren't sickened or disgusted or anything like that. But there's no sense that the old parties have any will to go anywhere else. And there's going to be some really exciting proposals in the next few weeks brought forward by non-politicians to really try and put on the table the alternatives that are out there
aren't currently looking at. Go to those in a few moments' time. But for the moment, you're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. Our guests in the studio are Major Brenda Noddle of the Salvation Army in Melbourne, Misha Coleman of the Church's Refugee Task Force, and Ross Gittins of the Sydney Morning Herald, economics editor. And we're talking about Australia. Have we become a meaner country? And is this now showing up in our basic service provision? We saw a census debacle last week. Some people sheeting at home to continued cutbacks to foundational government services, even basic services such as getting statistical information. We're seeing it in the way we treat refugees and asylum seekers. We're seeing it in our attitudes to the homeless. Are we becoming a meaner country? What's your opinion? Give us a call, 1300 800 222, 1300 800 222, on ABC Radio, and we'll take your calls for the next 20 minutes or so. Ross Gittins, do we see patterns emerging here? Is it coming down to basically You alluded to this in a column I read a week or so ago, that there's a common phenomenon emerging around the world at the moment. And you see it in Brexit, you see it in Donald Trump, and you see it in some of the attitudinal things springing up in Australia, that for 30 years an economic course has been followed that has led to a growing gap between the rich and the poor. And that's now showing up in the sort of social dislocation we're seeing.
I believe that's true. I think that's the underlying cause, even though you can't say, well, every sign that I've seen held up at a Trump rally has been about the gap between the rich and the poor. That's the thing that's been happening. I think there are a lot of fundamental factors in the economy. Technology, for example. Economists are very aware of what's called skill bias technological change. Technological change which favours people who are well educated and disadvantages people who are just doing some simple repetitive task. And globalisation is part of that. Now you can say, oh, well, globalisation was about deregulating and so on. Partly that's true, but really the thing that's driven globalisation, the biggest factor, the bigger factor, is actually technological change. Advances in telecommunications, we know what's happening in other countries. It's possible to sit in one country and organise things in another country in a way which 30 years ago was inconceivable. I heard of someone today who is a promoter. He lives in Sydney, but he organises concerts somewhere in Europe. And he does it all on the phone or, you know, on the internet. That's globalisation. Now, that is changing things. Manufacturing has moved to cheap labour countries, and that there's more of that going on. I don't actually think that's a bad thing, because I don't think that the only people who are entitled to a job are people who work in Australia. I think that people who work in China, be nice if they had a decent job too, and this is actually bringing it to them. But the point is, my point is this, on the one hand, we've had all these deep market forces that when you put them together favour high-income earners. They're shifting income from the bottom to the top. And superimposed on that, we've had people saying, oh, we really need to incentivize this economy, and so all those people on the top tax rate, they really need a tax cut so that they'll work harder. And, of course, the old joke says, and those people at the bottom, they need more stick to make them work harder.
Yes. Carrots and sticks misapplied.
This has been rolling on for 20 or 30 years, and everyone in the influential parts of the community have said, yes, this is what's got to happen. And nobody has said, hang on, the gap between the rich and poor has been getting wider for 30 years, actually since about the end of the 70s. So that's almost, that's longer than that. That gap has been getting wider. We've seen it getting wider.
And the stretching of the social contract is now straining.
Yes, yes.
And
at the same time, we're saying, well, of course, we couldn't possibly afford to increase the dole by more than prices.
You're on Sunday night. Time to take your calls. Let's take one or two calls straight up from Akesh in Keysborough in Melbourne first. Akesh, how are you? Thank you for joining us. And what's the point you'd like to make? Akesh, you there? Let me try again. Akesh, you there? Yeah, thank you for joining us.
Hello, can you hear me?
What would you like to say?
Well, I wanted to put out there that, where to start from? Now, I wanted to say that the Australian culture out there is to have a go. So am I right in saying that?
Well, we'd like to think we're all about having a go, yes.
So to more or less do our best, and what will be is the fact that we did our best. And it's actually pretty evident in the Olympics at the moment. You know, we're celebrating our athletes over there for just getting on the podium, which is a great thing. You know, it's good. We get out there, we do our best, we put our effort into it. Whereas, you know, you go to America, their attitude is winning is not everything; it's actually the only thing. So there's a very vast difference. But the point I'm trying to make, though, is you see people on the dole, and they say, "Well, we've done our best." Whereas you know that they haven't put their effort into it, where they can try and get off the dole and try to improve their lives, essentially. So that's one point I wanted to make in terms of the culture that Australia has, which is, you know, do you have a go? In saying that as well, it falls onto the public services that the government, don't fund well enough to actually assist those people to improve their lives. So I'm speaking as a public servant myself. I'm a public bus driver. I transport those people around on a daily basis. So essentially, I don't get paid enough here in Victoria. This is just Victoria. And they put more emphasis on... essentially... the public services here in for the census, for public transport, for all that sort of stuff doesn't get enough attention, and it doesn't help the wider society. And it is more evident that the amount of money they actually throw at the private corporations that actually operate those private services is that they do their best to pay the workers, so myself, as little as possible, and try and get away with it. And essentially, it doesn't help the quality of the services to allow, the public to operate. So the point is, the saying goes, you pay someone peanuts, you're going to get monkeys.
Akash, we'll take that as an insightful comment on the way you feel, because it wasn't a real question there, but thanks for your observations.
Just a comment there,
yeah,
John.
Brendan.
Look, we run a night cafe during winter in Melbourne. We see between 75 to 85 people a night sleeping on a concrete floor. People don't choose to be homeless, John. People don't choose to live on the New Start, where they're living one-third below the poverty line. People don't choose that lifestyle. And a lot of the people that we see that are homeless, a lot of people that we see that are really struggling to make ends meet, they're dealing with really complex issues. They're dealing with trauma that's often caused by abuse. They're dealing with really serious mental health issues, often addiction issues, because they're trying to ease the pain and they self-medicate, and they end up on a very slippery slope. So I just think it's a very dangerous path when we start actually blaming the victim, blaming the people that are in horrific situations, often through no fault of their own. And that's not the fair go that that I think a lot of people that I speak to really want to see happen in this country.
Thanks, Brendan. We'll say hi to Peter in Beecroft. Peter, hi. Peter? No Peter there in Beecroft? Can you hear us? Peter? Yeah. Peter. I'll try another phone. Peter, how are you?
I'm really well.
Yeah, sorry about that. I pressed the wrong phone.
That's all right.
Good on you. What would you like to say?
I've been watching this decline for the last 30 years, and it's no doubt in my mind that we the collective people of Australia, have closed down corporate Australia. And the reason I can say that is that you look at the statistics from ASIC, we've got 11 million taxpayers and 12.6 million businesses. So there's no work anymore, because there's no companies left to employ people. If there's no companies left to employ people, there's no tax revenue. If there's no tax revenue, there's no money left to pay the dole. So the guy from the Salvation Army should start looking not at the fact that there's no money for the dole. He should start looking at the fact that the money is not coming in from corporate Australia anymore.
All right. Well, Ross, we'll get you to comment on that first, because I think it's more an economic question than a...
Yes. If that, to the extent that that's true, and it's only true to a small extent, it's because corporate Australia have found ways of avoiding paying much tax. The fact is that corporate Australia is employing more people than they ever have. And the proportion of the electorate, a portion of the population that's in in a job is not as high as it's ever been, but it is quite high relative to the past. So it's the idea that sort of no one's working, there aren't any companies, that's just not true.
And the notion that the corporations need to sort of pay more of their fair share seems to be getting some traction, but not yet enough with the politicians.
Well, there are measures in this year's budget that I hope will be pretty effective. I think that finally, because politicians in almost all countries have realised that, you know, whether you're in America or you're in Britain or you're in Australia, these big companies are finding ways not to pay much using very strange arrangements with tax havens and pushing money in and pulling it out and turning it around again and pushing it out again. All these absolutely extraordinarily contrived arrangements to avoid paying tax. Business, for example, BHP, which sells a lot of coal and iron ore and stuff like that, that digs it out of the ground and sells it, they market that coal in Singapore. Now, why would you go to Singapore to market your coal that you're selling to China? Well, because there are tax advantages, that's why. I think the OECD and the group of 20, the G20, have been working on this, and I think they are finally starting to get somewhere. We'll see, but I am cautiously hopeful that we can do something about the fact that taxes become just about optional for companies that operate in a number of countries.
It seems that globalisation is now beginning to be structurally recognised and beginning to be dealt with, and not necessarily through the sort of demon of the United Nations. That is, governments are making decisions that we actually need to recognise this as a reality.
Well, yes, but you have to do it through some kind of international organisation. The problem here is that one country, even a big country, with the possible exception of America, but certainly Britain, they can't say, well, look, we're going to crack down on this and we'll be right. Because it's just so easy to say, well, that's okay, we'll move all our stuff out of Britain.
You're on Sunday nights. Time to take another call. Let's say hi to Brad in Lismore. Brad, how are you?
Oh, good evening, John. I'm well. How are you, John?
Yeah, good. What would you like to say?
I'd like to address a question to...
Can you keep it brief, Brad? Because we are running out of time. We've got lots of calls.
Yes, yes. I'd like to ask her whether she thinks that the Australian people, the majority, are cowards in terms of the freedoms that the people in Nauru, and not just in Nauru, but all over Australia, need to preserve.
Misha, perhaps you could tell us about the initiatives you've got coming up to address that question of getting the Australian populace on side, and whether or not we're cowards when it comes to standing up for people.
Yes, no, I don't think we are cowards, and certainly, you know, the task force represents 900 different Christian organisations across Australia, and none of them are cowards. Actually, they're very progressive Christians, and they, you know, have their own battles on the home sort of front with regards to sort of, you know, being out with some very progressive policies. And look, they're not my policies. That there's a whole range of different ways we could go about this, John. So just to give you one example. Quickly. Every year, Australia takes about 200,000 people permanently into Australia. Now, there is no reason that we couldn't take a great deal many more people who are also people fleeing, you know, wars and the Taliban and, you know, female genital mutilation. That we have this tiny little proportion, you know, 13,000 people currently that we take, and they're called asylum seekers. Actually, a lot of those people who are seeking asylum are electrical engineers. They're all sorts of skilled people. We've all met taxi drivers who are waiting for, you know, their visa applications to go through, who, you know, are medical graduates and all sorts of skilled people. So one alternative is to say, let's look at our overall migration intake. Let's look at that whole 200,000. And why not try and match up people from countries that are really, you know, really not good places to live, and, you know, especially for young girls. And why not look at the skills that they can bring and allow them to apply for skilled visas or study places? Why can't those people be applicants for, you know, a student visa? Why do they have to be one of these, you know, 10,000, 12,000 places that are for people seeking asylum?
And more initiatives will be yet to come over the next 12 months, I understand.
Yes, very soon, John, coming your way.
We shall wait with, well, not bated breath, perhaps, but in genuine anticipation. We're running out of time. We've only got a couple of minutes left. Brendan Noddle, let me come to you. As somebody who has been dealing with this problem now on the streets of Melbourne for 10 years, you're saying that the people of Australia that you encounter on the streets, ordinary citizens, still have an acute social conscience. Yet we elect governments who seem, at the moment, unable to come to terms with the questions of justice. What, for you, would be the critical measure in the issues you're dealing with, the sign of a government that's willing to come to terms with what Australia really is and what Australia really aspires to?
Well, I think on some of the really entrenched issues, John, we'd love to see a bipartisan approach. We've got, you know, the homeless issue we'd call a crisis. There are a number of other issues that would fit into that category as well. And we'd love to see just a coming together of people from a range of different political parties and working with experts to come up with a strategy and then working with that strategy beyond the electoral cycle. I think what we're really looking for is leadership around some of these significant issues rather than perhaps people, politicians that respond to the lowest common denominator or respond to the upcoming electoral cycle.
All right, Ross Gittins, that becomes a key question, the politicians. We seem to have politicians who are locked into corners at the moment, whether Malcolm Turnbull, it's the Prime Minister, he seems to be drawing on people who have a profoundly different economic philosophy to his own in his own party. Where does this go? Do you see a way forward? Do you see us?
Well, I think the way forward...
You've got 30 seconds.
The way forward is for the Labor Party to say, these guys are on the floor. We could start kicking them, or we could hold back and cooperate with the government to achieve something. We'll probably win the next election anyway, because this lot aren't all that wonderful. But I don't... If we have another 3 years in which the Labor Party just kicks these guys before we're down, the whole of Australia will pay.
Ross Gittins, Brendan Noddle, Misha Coleman, thanks very much for scratching the surface of a very difficult issue.